Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome our guest co-host, Dr. Matthew Hall, from the UNC Department of Preventive Medicine. Welcome, Matt.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be here, too. And it's good to know that we're going to have a really great guest today. We're going to be talking with epidemiologist Dr. Ali Rouhani, professor for the study and prevention of violence at the University of Washington, about how gun violence affects survivors and generations long after the initial trauma. This type of conversation is really on my mind a lot in light of every day the news of mass shootings.
Yes, it's a constant reminder in the headlines and also just in our thoughts as we are concerned about our family and those that we love.
You know, we just saw really horrific shootings this past year at so many places, including in New Zealand, at the Christchurch, Sri Lanka, last year at Parkland, and the mass shooting in Pittsburgh. I think his research, Dr. Rouhani's, will be helpful for us to understand what we might be able to do to better prevent some of the long-term consequences of exposure to that violence.
Absolutely.
First, let's talk about some of the research that matters. And this very first one is something I get asked pretty regularly. You probably get asked through your work and our clinics as well about the difference in recording blood pressure readings with devices people use at home, like the arm or the wrist. What are they talking about here?
Well, recent studies have been looking at just how effectively a wrist monitor blood pressure can compare with the one you get in the doctor's office. I think some companies such as Apple are really pushing this idea that you can monitor your blood pressure from home and as you move around, and it's just as good or better than what you get in the doctor's office. The advent and the increased use of commercially available and convenient blood pressure monitors, such as the Apple Watch, I think is allowing people to monitor their blood pressure more often and feel like they're getting more and better care. But the study that recently came out highlights that the blood pressures that are actually being monitored are pretty inaccurate, and they can be low or high, and this can lead doctors and patients to make uninformed decisions about it.
Yeah, this research that was in the journal Hypertension was done in Australia with a team that looked at blood pressures of the upper arm and then the wrist of 180 adults, but they were all undergoing coronary angiography. So I was like, initially I thought, oh, this is just like my patients. But I thought, well, no, they're not like my patient. And I think that's one of the problems. I think you are absolutely right that there's discrepancies, and the wrist reading tended to be higher more often than the arm. And so that might call into question home monitors, but this wasn't necessarily about home monitors. They did it at the office, so whether it's the same as the ones you would have at home and the comparison, but it does suggest that they aren't the same thing as being measured here. I think the take home for me is that, you know, if you have a home monitor and it's a wrist monitor, and if it's your blood pressure is really low, it's probably good. You know, obviously, if it was high, that's a concern, and maybe if you're not certain. And I do think you should bring the monitor in at home that you're using to actually compare to what they're checking in the office, which is the gold standard, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And that might be a helpful way of saying, is my monitor consistently getting what I'm getting in the office?
Yeah, and I think that at best, it's an indicator of how your health is and shouldn't be used to make decisions.
Well, talking about making decisions, a lot of times going from the other end of the age spectrum, looking at children, and I remember having had three children, can remember everything, is that some of them were perhaps a little bit more picky eaters than others. I think I was an incredibly picky eater. Not sure if I had chronic constipation. I don't remember that element, but if you are a picky eater and you have a chronic constipation, that suggests to these researchers there might be something else going on.
Right. I totally agree. I know I have a toddler at home, and I think our number one concerns are how much he's eating and how much he's pooping. And I think that's a common concern among parents. And this study kind of looks at pairing the two together and this relationship between eating and bowel movements. And the study of children between 3 and 5 years old who had chronic constipation was compared to children who didn't have constipation, and to see if there were differences in oral sensory processing. So basically, like the way that the children interpreted the sensation of eating or sensations in their mouth.
So they might have the texture of the food, the taste of the food, the odor of the food that are displeasing, and that might be interpreted as picky eating, but that actually is a sensory processing disorder that might actually have some other underlying issues that you need to worry about.
Right. And one of the things that the study highlights is that there is this relationship. I think it's important to note that it's not necessarily a causal relationship, meaning the picky eating isn't causing the constipation, but they are related to each other. And it's not entirely clear if you help them eat better or reduce that sensation, whether the constipation will get better.
But certainly, it's a kind of a little bit of a red flag, and I think it can help doctors and patients.
Absolutely.
Speaking of this next research that can certainly help patients, I think it can help all doctors too, is about skipping breakfast and stroke and heart attack risk. And I got to be honest, I didn't have breakfast today.
I did, fortunately enough. So.
And that means you're going to live longer than me.
I suppose so.
No. It doesn't mean that at all, Matt. It means that statistically, if I were to continuously skip breakfast and you were continuously to eat breakfast, among a large population of people, that I would tend to have a higher risk of heart attack and strokes. But this actually wakes me up a little bit and says, this is important. We should be advising people to have breakfast. It lowers the risk of diabetes. And now heart attacks and strokes, at least it looks like that could be the case.
Right. It's definitely an interesting finding, this correlation with having breakfast and having a heart attack or stroke. One of the interesting things that we need to consider, though, is that there was no defining of what a breakfast is.
It wasn't a bacon McMuffin.
Exactly. Or, you know, a soda of any sorts.
Biscuit and sweet tea.
Exactly. So I think that we still should be exercising smart eating choices when we have breakfast as part of a whole dietary plan.
Let's talk about real briefly our last research that matters. And this is fascinating. It's about voice analysis software. We might call it kind of artificial intelligence and the learning software that could help veterans and really perhaps anyone who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder be diagnosed.
Right. It's certainly an emerging field when we are talking about computer learning, artificial intelligence, ways to identify people who are at risk of self-harm, whether it's PTSD or other mental health problems. And this study basically analyzed the voice patterns of individuals who had PTSD and those who did not among veterans and war veterans specifically. And with 89% accuracy, was able to tell who had PTSD and who did not.
And I think they were suggesting this could be a test in a doctor's office. I'm not certain because it would have to see how does this compare to a gold standard, which is probably a questionnaire. But it is interesting. I think it could be very helpful for people who perhaps don't want to fill out a questionnaire, and they may be able to simply speak into an app or other and then be diagnosed and then be referred. I think this is a tool to say, oh, if this is there, it could be helpful to seek help. I think that would be important.
Absolutely that. And I think that if someone was concerned that maybe they may be developing symptoms, it was a way to kind of track it and to be an indicator for help.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Matt and I will be talking with Dr. Ali Rouhani, Bartley Dobb Professor for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Washington, about how gun violence affects survivors and generations long after their initial trauma. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matthew Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matthew Hall. Today on Conversations, we're talking with epidemiologist Dr. Ali Rouhani, Bartley Dobb Professor for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Washington, about how gun violence affects survivors throughout generations, long after the initial trauma. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Rouhani.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, this is such a sensitive and important topic. I'm so glad to have you as our guest today. And I guess we would like to know a little bit about your path to really taking on a problem of not only significance in your state and this country, but worldwide.
Thank you for asking that question, actually, because it's not a very straightforward one. I studied epidemiology, mainly studying epidemiology of infectious diseases. That's how I started my career. And I was very focused on vaccine epidemiology, epidemiology of vaccine preventable diseases and vaccine safety. I had just joined the University of Washington Faculty School of Public Health in 2012 when the Sandy Hook tragedy occurred. And it was at that time, actually the day after Sandy Hook, that I focused on gun violence and firearm injury as a major public health and public safety problem. And since then, I have devoted essentially all of my scholarly work and research into this area.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how this research has affected your life as you've pursued it.
Yes, so I came to the United States in 2003. I was born and raised in the Middle East, in Iran, and I practiced there as a physician. When I came to this country, one of the things that I noticed was, in terms of public health problems, one of them was this issue. It was interesting because I grew up actually in the midst of Iraq-Iran war, so I was very familiar with the concept of violence, especially collective violence. But even when I practiced medicine, I rarely saw patients with firearm injuries over there. At the civilian level, it is not a public health problem over there. When I came here, in the news, in the media, in conversations with colleagues at the School of Public Health, the School of Medicine, I over and over was exposed to this issue, and I couldn't help but think what strategies we could use to prevent and control it. As an American now, I deeply care about it, and I think there is a growing number of our citizens who are thinking about this issue more and more and thinking about strategies that could be employed to prevent it and mitigate this really heavy toll on our society. I work at a trauma center. At a trauma center, as you know, we interact on a daily basis with trauma surgeons and other individuals who have these tragic narratives and stories of patients that they see and the devastation that they see up front every day. And we talk about, we brainstorm about, we chat about ways that we could make a difference and move the needle on this issue.
What's remarkable, and I don't think I had thought about this before, is when we talk about these mass shootings, we tend to remember them by a word or two words, by a location: Columbine, Sandy Hook, Parkland, the Pittsburgh massacre. And it's as if we reduce this amazing toll to something that has a collective memory. And I'm wondering, we know that those mass shootings, however terrible they are, aren't as violent in terms of the numbers killed as what happens every day with suicides and homicides around the world, but yet they stimulate collective fear. What's it like to study those two disparate but connected problems?
I think that's an excellent question. So the World Health Organization, as you know, in the typology of violence, categorizes it into three different categories or classes of violence: interpersonal violence, self-directed violence, and collective violence, like war. And the reality is that in this country, about 300 individuals sustain a firearm injury every day, as you just mentioned. So 300 individuals sustain a firearm injury every day. about 90 or 100 of them die on a daily basis, and about 200, 210 sustain non-fatal injuries that could be paralyzing and could be long-lasting. So what is remarkable here is that in terms of numbers, mass shootings constitute less than 1% of the number of deaths that we have in this country. So the casualties at the population level, when you compare to the day-to-day gun violence that we talk about, and especially self-directed violence, which is suicide, as you rightly mentioned, the numbers pale compared to those other types of firearm injuries. However, because of their apparent unpredictability and because of the fear at the collective level, at the population level, at the community level that they generate, they completely stand out compared to the so-called day-to-day gun violence or death by suicide that happens at homes on a daily basis when we never hear about them. So I think we have to be very careful about this and aware of the magnitude and the scope of these issues, comparatively speaking. Having said that, I also want to emphasize that because of lack of really rigorous research on the consequences of mass shootings, especially long-lasting effects of that, which was the impetus for this editorial after the three tragic deaths by suicide that we experienced just a few weeks ago, we also don't have a good sense of, in terms of the quantification, the scope of the trauma and negative consequences of mass shooting in the communities years after they happen. So I think the two of these should go hand in hand. One is that they are a small, very small proportion of firearm deaths in this country, and at the same time, they may have unique features that distinguish them from the so-called day-to-day gun violence or suicide in terms of their outcomes.
I think that every parent is worried about gun violence with their child, and you had described the, just the variety of different ways that can happen. I think as a parent, the one thing I really want to know is, like, what can we do? What should we do?
That's the multi-million dollar question here. Many parents ask us about the same question. I personally believe that we really don't have, you know, one specific, one magic solution. These really hard problems require a multifaceted, multi-pronged approach. I doubt that there is one policy, for example, that could cut the risk of these by, let's say, 90% or 80%. I think that is entirely unreasonable to think that way. I really believe it would have to be multi-components. Mental health, I'm sure you both are aware, it should be at the heart of our interventions. When you think about some of the major risk factors for some of these tragic, horrific events, you see that mental health is a big component of it. And we need to do way better in terms of providing those resources, both at the community level and at schools. Many of these mass shootings, as you know, also happen in schools, so they gain a new level of importance because of the population that they affect.
We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Ali Rouhani, Bartley Dodd Professor of Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Washington, about how gun violence can affect survivors and generations long after the initial trauma. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Matthew Hall. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Ali Rouhani, Bartley Dobb Professor for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Washington, about how gun violence affects survivors and generations long after their initial trauma. And right before the break, Dr. Rouhani, you were really talking about this distinction, this unique distinction in part that these mass shootings have because of their impact and the fear it can generate among so many of us throughout society, people who have children or grandchildren in our school systems. And I'm wondering, you wrote this really interesting article in the Journal of the American Medical Association just recently about the long-lasting consequences of gun violence and mass shootings. And in this viewpoint, you discuss the role that bullying may play as not accounting for all of the problems, but it seems to be a common pathway for many of it. Can you talk about that and then what efforts are being made to really change the natural act of preventing bullying from becoming a mass shooting?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, it's just one of potentially many causal factors here. In terms of the scope of bullying, there is research out there that shows that it, depending on the setting, it may vary from 9% to more than 80 or 90% when we think about, you know, lifetime chances of getting bullied. But overall, I think one out of every five students report being bullied at the national level. And there are concerns that trend is increasing. In terms of the contribution or the causal relationship between bullying and some of these mass shootings, what we know, or school shootings in general, what we know is that they do have a stronger role in those shootings that involve retaliation, and especially with multiple victims. And that's why there are efforts made in certain parts of the country, certain school settings, and really trying to take this head on and implement strategies in school setting to reduce the risk of bullying. One of the things that we hear these days frequently, as you all know, is this idea of hardening our schools in terms of security measures. And I believe that it's important to do so. There should be a reasonable level of physical security in buildings, whether it's in school or beyond the school setting. However, I strongly believe that those should not come at the cost of forgetting about other aspects of prevention, such as emotional security beyond just physical security. And one of those factors that's really important is bullying. It's not the only one, but it's one of the most important ones. At the same time, interventions focused on reducing depression and anxiety, comorbidities that are common among youth and adolescents, also is incredibly important. And one thing we have learned, we have seen, is that in the wake of these tragedies, there is this pouring of support for these communities. Unfortunately, what we are trying here to say is that some of those resources vanish over time. Maybe there is a surge of attention and resources in the first 6 months, in the first year, in the first 2 years or 3 years, but after that, people are mostly left with lives that have been devastated. So we are promoting the idea of a longer term, more sustained level of support for these communities to not only heal them, but also prevent the recurrence of some of these. I always think about trauma as a recurrent disease, as a chronic condition at the individual level. I truly believe that's the same at the community level too. Communities can be re-traumatized again. And we have seen that now in Sandy Hook. Now we have seen that in Newtown, Connecticut. We're seeing that in Parkland. So we're seeing that those communities are being re-traumatized again because of these incidents of violence, whether it's self-directed or interpersonal. So I really think these interventions should be provided at the community level in a sustained manner and well supported for the healing to be completed. And that's, we feel, it's the missing link here in our system of support.
And you mentioned in your article about the tragic loss of the two students and a father of a student from the Sandy Hook and Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that recently happened. And I was wondering if you could comment that, especially in context to what you had just described.
Yeah, these tragic deaths, these three losses were really painful for those communities, as you know. Two of them were students, the survivors of the Parkland shooting, and one of them was the father of a young girl who was murdered in Sandy Hook. And these deaths, they happened within the span of 2 weeks. And I am trying to be very careful here to avoid saying that these are directly causally related. I don't know. I'm not sure if anybody necessarily knows. So I don't think we should draw necessarily causal conclusions at the individual level. But what is clear here is that events such as these shootings can generate a whole host of untoward mental health consequences, such as depression and anxiety, hopelessness, helplessness, lack of any hope. And this cumulative effect over time could result in self-directed harm. So I think there is no doubt about some of those mental health consequences of these mass shootings, and also there is no doubt that some of those mental health consequences are indeed risk factors for suicide. So it is conceivable that those events played a role, potentially a major role, along with other risk factors that were present before these tragic deaths happened. So what we are saying is that maybe we can't control, if you will, all aspects of somebody's life, but maybe what we can do is that if we offer resources in the long term after these incidents, maybe we can reduce the number of some of these tragedies. And that's something that I think is, to me, it's a moral imperative, to be completely honest with you. I think it's something that we have to do because we have seen so many of these events, and these are lives that are being lost, and we can do better in terms of the allocation of resources to do this. Now, one of the things that we in violence prevention, and I'm sure both of you are well aware of this, always talk about is the issue of stigma. I talked about mental health a lot, and I continue to believe that resources should be devoted to that. But this shouldn't come at the cost of stigmatizing individuals who have mental illness, because the overwhelming majority of people with mental illness are not violent people. They don't commit interpersonal crime. Many of them, a larger proportion of them than the general population, may sustain self-directed harm, but a very rare proportion of them are violent toward other people. I want to make sure that we clarify that. And maybe we can discuss this as we continue the conversation, but also the issue of policy. I think policy is also really important. And so there are ways to employ and implement policies that we think reasonably can reduce this toll. I think the Parkland one comes to mind, where everybody knows there were clear red flags for that individual. People made comments that he is going to explode any day and kill people. So how come we miss that? So I think there are policies we could promote that could be effective in, for example, in this case, not having this such individual have ready access to firearms and kill so many people.
I was really privileged and humbled to hear Lori Aildef, who lost her daughter in Parkland, speaking recently, and from what she called grief to belief. And she and her family really worked on school safety reform after her daughter was tragically killed, and laws passed that very simply kind of, they're not about gun control, they're about safety reform and things to come together. And I wonder, and we have about a minute left, what advice would you offer, because it is the survivors frequently of this gun violence that we have opportunities to work and to change trajectories. What advice would you offer them and their loved ones in order to protect themselves against long-term serious adverse health effects?
That's an excellent question. I think they should continue to speak up. I think that is one form of healing. They should be aware of their own health and well-being. If there are symptoms and signs that they feel like they come back, they should definitely seek counseling to the extent possible. If among themselves or among their loved ones, they see some of these signs and symptoms, I think they should proactively talk about them and get help. We know from the evidence that's not just the geographic proximity to the location of the mass trauma, but also emotional proximity that is really, really important. So trying to help each other, trying to get help to the extent possible, and be aware of signs and symptoms, especially self-directed harm, I think is really important. There are wonderful opportunities at the community level, at the national level, for issues of suicide prevention that I think especially the survivors of mass shootings and these mass trauma need to be aware of.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Ali Rohani, Professor of the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Washington, about your advice and wisdom of how we can all maybe come together to help survivors long after initial trauma. Thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Matthew Hall. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking with listeners about their health questions and concerns. And Matt, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
Last week, I went to a hockey game. One of the things that the announcers would do to get the crowd excited was to encourage everyone to yell, cheer, what have you, at higher and higher decibels. Needless to say, many people go to hockey games yearly, as well as other sporting or entertainment events that thrive on a loud, cheering crowd and music. It made me wonder, though, are the things that we're doing for fun contributing at a great rate for hearing loss?
What a great question. I've been at playoff hockey games, and I can tell you, it's really loud. I've seen noise levels greater than 100 decibels. That's not a good level to be exposed, is it, Matt?
No, that's definitely at the levels where you can experience significant hearing loss.
Yeah, if it's prolonged and sustained. I do know that when you leave these events, your ears are ringing. If your ears are ringing, like after going to a concert, that means you've been exposed too long to too high a pitch at too high a level. I've also known that, like, when you go to NASCAR events, you see people there with headphones all the time. I saw people with earplugs at the hockey game. I do think this is a concern. I think for parents, particularly of young children, even parents of all ages, adults of all ages, it'd be worthwhile to take earplugs in. They may say, oh, it heightens their experience, but it also heightens the likelihood you're going to lose your hearing.
Right. I think in some instances, even double hearing protection is warranted, which often happens at racing car games where people have the plug-in ear protection and then ear muffs that go over the top to add a little bit more.
Yeah, I've seen people with those cowbells, too, and they start hitting those cowbells right behind you. It's like, please don't do that. We could just have a really good time. I'm glad my team won. I can cheer. I don't need to be noise deafening. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 10-year-old son has some environmental allergies, and his doctor recently asked if we were interested in starting some allergy shots for him. What do you think about allergy shots?
You know, not a lot of family doctors give allergy shots today. It used to be that a lot of them did, but I think allergy shots with severe allergies can be life-changing.
Right. I think that jumping to allergy shots is probably a little extreme, and there are much more reasonable and conservative things you can do first to help your little one.
Yeah, and I would imagine that hopefully, if they're working with an allergist, they really will have tried a lot of the common sense things about environmental things to, you know, reduce dust, to have better filters, to get rid of carpets, to vacuum, all of those things inside, make sure there's no exposure to smoke or secondhand smoke in the environment, and then trying all the medications. If, however, those things that are really been tried don't seem to be doing it, then, you know, gradually increasing exposure to immunologic responses, it may be the only thing that actually works once you've tried everything else. Mm. So I think working with your allergist really well, good idea.
Yes.
Laura, what's our next house call?
Recently, I've been experiencing significant acid reflux almost daily. Prior to this change, I hadn't really experienced it all that often, maybe once a month or so. I haven't changed my diet to any great degree, and I was curious if you had any advice for me.
Oh, we always have advice. Advice is free. You know, it's interesting. I hear and appreciate the question. I also know that lots of times people aren't aware of things they've changed. I saw a patient just yesterday, Matt, who was having some abdominal pain and said, you know, have you done anything different in your medicines? No. But found out that they had a bruise and they had fallen. And, you know, they were just taking over-the-counter Advil, three of them, three times a day.
Right, which can definitely cause stomach problems and reflux-like symptoms, absolutely.
Yeah, so, but on the other hand, you know, could there be something else going on? The answer is yes, and it should be looked at because have you tried antacids? You know, have you developed it? This organism, it's H. pylori, you know, maybe you've acquired that organism that could be causing an ulcer. And it also may not be an ulcer. It may be reflux or some other thing you're doing with the gallbladder or something else.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things most likely to consider is that you've done something different in your diet or in your behavior and try to make those changes up front. And then if it becomes a concern, then you should go and definitely and see your provider about it.
I saw one patient not too long ago who said nothing was different. And then I happened to look at something that gave me a clue that perhaps they drink more than is healthy. Mm. And said, yeah, I have about two beers a day and two shots of bourbon a day. I thought, that's probably contributing to some of your symptoms.
Right.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
My teenage son has a really hard time getting up in the morning for school. It's challenging for him to actually wake up, and even when he does get up on time, he moves about half speed. He goes to bed later than I'd like him to, but it's not drastically late, and he often ends up late for school as a result. I'd love any advice to help him deal with a sleep pattern that just doesn't seem to be working.
Well, we can pray that he gets older. Right? Or when he gets younger. You may remember that time when you have a young child that your child takes naps.
Absolutely. Yep.
And as you get older, I think you take naps. Right. So there's something about that nap taking. You know, I wonder what time school starts. You know, we know that school that starts at 8 o'clock is not wired to a growing adolescent brain, that mm-hmm. school really should start later because adolescents do better. They perform better in school.
Right. Absolutely. And we know that your sleep pattern changes over time and that teenagers especially are prone to stay up longer than just as part of their normal physiology, to stay up longer and to sleep later at night.
I think developing good sleep hygiene, though, and some rules of the house about putting the phone and the stimulation down, a time in which you need to be out. I think this is where sometimes it may be helpful to have your doctor, your primary care doctor, maybe a therapist involved here, because there could be other things going on. We shouldn't just assume this is just teenage years, which actually there's a lot going on in teenage years, and so it could be stress, anxiety, some other things that would be worth talking about.
Right, absolutely. I think depression is also something that people should really be concerned about if there are behavioral changes with their adolescent.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls for today, and we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send us any question at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest today, Dr. Ali Rahani, and our great guest co-host today, Dr. Matthew Hall. We'll look forward to joining you next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Matthew Hall.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.